Okay, Kingstolver versus Attorney General, Ms. Moses.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Mary Helen Moses, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Annette Kingstolver. One of the issues about reviewing summary judgment is, could a reasonable jury return a verdict for the movement? And the movement in this case is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The record is clear that a reasonable jury could not find for the Bureau. One of the things that, a key factor in this case that the trial court didn't pay a whole lot of attention to is the fact that Ms. Kingstolver had been performing GS-12 duties as a GS-7 employee for 2.5 years. She got new supervisors in the fall of 2006, and both of them were from outside the agency. Neither one of them knew of her past performance or anything along those lines. She had a documented disability, cardiac arrhythmia, and depression. And it's the cardiac arrhythmia that's the most serious thing in this complaint. The cardiac arrhythmia was brought on by stress at work, work-related stress. We know that when she first complained about her cardiac arrhythmia and requested accommodation, that both of her supervisors were biased against her. That's sworn testimony that's in the report, that's in the record.
Who testified that her supervisors were biased against her?
Her supervisors did. They admitted it.
Because of her disability?
Yes. Mr. Brandon, who was her second line supervisor, said, and this is at document 19, page 195. I personally doubt her intentions were ever genuine with staying on the budget team. I believe she applied for the GS-9 budget position with the intent of getting higher pay and then trying to transfer to another position within the academy. I also believe Annette did not like working for Abra, which is first line supervisor, okay. An African-American female.
Okay, that doesn't sound like bias, but I appreciate you clarifying what the testimony talking about.
Establishes that he was suspicious of her motives.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I think it is bias in terms of trying to resolve a reasonable accommodation request. Ms. Reed said that...
She requested two accommodations, right? A lateral transfer and leave without pay?
Correct.
Okay. And as I understand it, the transfer was denied because they said there was no vacancy in any job for which she was qualified.
Correct.
Where's the evidence to the contrary?
We don't challenge that, Your Honor.
So they were entitled to deny that accommodation, right? And then leave without pay, the district court said she didn't point to any evidence that showed that she requested leave for a specific period of time. And that your client told Latney Reed that she needed to get away. We've said an indefinite period of leave just is not a reasonable request.
Your Honor, respectfully, that ruling has been made in cases where the employee had abused leave, had been taking leave, that has not been applied to a first-time request for leave. And in fact, what we have here is they're offering her paid leave. Yeah. The government admits that they offered her paid leave. They just didn't want to do leave without pay.
And so I don't understand that. Why, if the government's willing to give you leave, or the government, your employer, whoever it is,
correct,
is willing to give you leave, and you say, I don't want leave on your terms, Mr. Employer, I want leave on my terms, how is that reasonable?
Well, how is it reasonable for the government to require her to exhaust her administrative leave when leave without pay is available? And well, the indefiniteness...
I guess I don't know. I mean, it just seems like if you're saying I need leave to address my disability as a reasonable accommodation for my disability, right? She needs leave. That's what she needs, right? She needs to not be in the environment, to take some time off, whatever. And the government says, go right ahead, do that. But it will be vacation and it will be paid. I understand she's would prefer some other kind of leave or something else, but I'm trying to connect that to her disability. Like, her disability would have been remedied by the kind of leave that the government offered, right?
Correct.
Okay.
It would have been.
Well, then why didn't she take it?
She suggested throughout that she wanted to keep her annual leave because she had a son who was in Alaska.
Right, but that doesn't have anything to do with her disability. I mean, I understand, that's the thing. I get why she says, I want both unlimited unpaid leave and the paid leave that I have. But that has nothing to do with her disability. The thing that she needs to remedy her disability is just leave of some kind.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. But on the other hand, is it reasonable to require her to take paid leave? It seems to me there's less of a hardship on the employer if she takes unpaid leave than if she takes paid leave.
Well, except that she wants to take, from the employer's perspective, which, I mean, I don't have in this case, but I can just see what they're saying, which is if it's the paid leave that you've already saved up, then we know how much you're taking. There's some limit to that. We've given you that as part of your employment. You know, what she's saying is I want unpaid leave, and then I want even more. So from the employer's perspective, it's like, okay, what are we talking about? Like a year, like 6 months, 18 months? I mean, there's no effective limit on her ability to take that leave. So I think that's what they're saying.
Well, the indefinite leave issue has not arisen in a first-time request, okay?
But you say indefinite leave is okay as long as you ask for it once?
No, sir. I'm saying that indefinite leave has been prohibited or... not followed in situations where the employee has a long history of taking leave, has been out on leave, has not given any...
I understand what you say has been done in the past, but what I'm trying to understand is the implication of your argument about why it shouldn't happen here because it was only the first time. And we're to say it's okay to ask for an indefinite period of leave as long as you do it once?
As long as it's not abused, Your Honor. If she asked for indefinite leave and came back in 2 weeks, we wouldn't be here.
Right.
Okay.
Well, it seems to me that that's just an unreasonable request, no matter when it's made. I'd like some time away. I don't know when I'll come back. That can't be reasonable for any employer.
There's no testimony that she ever said that. She just asked for leave without pay.
I know. I'm just talking about what we would hold, okay?
Right. Well, Your Honor.
And what the implication of that would be for other cases.
Well, let's say she had taken her accrued leave. She would have been out 6 weeks, okay? So it couldn't have been an undue hardship for them, for the agency, to grant her that 6 weeks of leave. The only difference here is whether we're going to call it unpaid or paid leave. And all of the EEOC guidance and even the DOJ manual says extended leave is an appropriate accommodation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, I could absolutely see someone coming and suing and saying, I wanted to take leave, and they told me no, I couldn't. I had to stay here. I couldn't leave. I could see that. That sounds like a perfectly legitimate claim. But here, it seems like the only sort of delta between what she wanted and what they were offering is that she could walk out of the door and go on vacation and do whatever she wanted to, but she was going to participate in the program that they already had for her instead of some additional category of leave that they didn't already have a program for. And how does that delta between the paid leave and the unpaid leave, how is that anything to do with her disability at all? You know?
In particular, it does not.
Okay, well then that's...
But I guess it depends on which side is reasonable and which is unreasonable. It seems to me unreasonable that they should require her to take paid leave when she is asking to take unpaid leave. Okay. She would have been entitled to that under the federal FMLA.
Yeah, if she hadn't already used her paid leave, right? I mean, I guess
FMLA doesn't have an exhaustion requirement that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
I don't. Every employer that I've ever worked with makes you use your paid leave before you get unpaid leave under FMLA. So if you've already got 6 weeks of paid leave, you don't get when you use that leave for a FMLA purpose. I mean, this is just practical. Every employer I've ever had. If you use FMLA leave and you've got paid leave, you use up your paid leave as part of your FMLA. It's not like on top of, right?
I'm over my time. May I respond?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, you can.
No, I have to try to remember what I was going to say.
Well, FMLA requires that leave be offered, right? Not that it be paid, unpaid, vacation, sick, anything.
It provides for 12 weeks of unpaid leave.
Of leave. It doesn't have to be. They could pay you if they want to, right?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think it's unpaid. In any event, this isn't an FMLA
case.
Don't
violate the law if it is unpaid. That's different from whether it's okay for the employer to give you pay, which they clearly can.
But, Your Honor, I think it is a violation of the law for her employers, her supervisors, to misrepresent the availability of paid leave. There was no rule. They've never pointed to any rule. The government has never pointed to any rule that said she had to exhaust it prior to that. They said that that was a rule, and Mr. Brandon said that was his practice. But there never was a rule, and okay. They misrepresented that to her the entire time.
I think we understand, Ms. Moses. Let's hear from the government.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Michael Label for the Attorney General. I have three different ways that the court can resolve this case very easily and put this case to rest. It's long overdue. But the court had asked some of my colleagues before this argument, you know, what's the most expedient way to get rid of this case? If I understand my esteemed colleague on the other side that we're only challenging the leave without pay.
I doubt I said get rid of it. I suspect I said decide it.
Decide it. I'm sorry, Your Honor. That if we're only talking about leave without pay and one purportedly requested accommodation that was not granted. As the panel noted, I mean, the easiest way to get rid of it is just going to be pursuant to the Wood case and other binding precedent. The court has said that indefinite leave is per se unreasonable or facially unreasonable. The Wood case says something to the effect of the ADA covers individuals who can perform the essential functions presently or in the immediate future. So the rationale underlying the indefinite leave applies here
as
well.
I need 6 weeks or whatever.
Exactly.
Would this be a different case if she used up her paid leave, her 6 weeks, and then she requested additional leave because of her disability?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it would. I mean, because I think the EEOC guidance, which I think cuts in our favor under these circumstances, but it continually says that extended leave, and of course we have the manual. So yes, if she had no more leave, and she had used up her leave.
But the extended leave would still need to be for a specific period.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Otherwise, you're changing the essential function. And there's cases that say attendance is an essential function, of course. The employer needs to have some idea or can anticipate when you're going to come back and do the actual job that you've agreed upon you're going to do.
Do you agree with the point that Judge Brasher's been making that the employer is entitled to have the employee exhaust first.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's accrued pay, the employee's accrued paid leave.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that is what the EEOC guidance indicates that with the rule 28J filed Wednesday afternoon indicates. And then there's a administrative ruling, an EEOC ruling. EEOC, of course, is the expert on these sorts of things, and that's entitled to some weight, and that's a Kendra W V agency, and that's a 2014 agency decision. Absolutely, Your Honor, and of course, it's also black letter law that an employee cannot require the employer to get to give the employee the preferred accommodation. It just has to be a reasonable accommodation. So again, if we're looking for the most expedient way, I think Wood and the other binding cases under this court's prior panel rule should dispose of the case pretty quickly there. Big picture wise, I think it's readily apparent from the record, and it jumps out, that Ms. Kingsolver is not a qualified individual with a disability. It's undisputed that a qualified individual must be able to perform the essential functions of the job with or without accommodation. And there are a few things that are abundantly clear from this record, that working in the FRED program, that is the accounting software, is an essential function of the job. That's in our statement of material facts, number 9, that was not disputed at 21-17 at page 2. There's the job description, which is 21-6 in the record, and there's Brandon's testimony, the second level supervisor, 21-5 at 77. This is a manuscript deposition. It's page 303, dead on point. So that's established. There's no dispute about that. Similarly,
I don't know. Just speaking for me, I'm far less comfortable affirming on a ground like this, where she says she was suffering from crippling stress, than assuming that she was a qualified individual who had a disability.
Of course, it was raised below, so the court can affirm on any basis that's supported by the record.
And the district court did assume it, too, that she had a disability, right?
Yeah, it assumed it, because it reached it on the other ground that the only one request that was made, or within the time frame, the only one legally sufficient request had been granted to her. So that's obviously available to the court as well. And that's the route the district court take. My counterpart hasn't talked much about exhaustion today. I'm not sure where they stand on that. But of course, it's relatively well clear under this court's Shiver precedential decision and others that the claimant must exhaust with the agency, and must first make contact within 45 days. It's undisputed that was not done here. All of those other ones fall outside the window. The briefs talk about potential tolling, and this court's precedents, of course, make very clear that equitable tolling is a extraordinary remedy, applied sparingly. Plaintiff bears the burden of showing that. Plaintiff must exercise due diligence, et cetera. And the district court indicated that there was no showing of due diligence, and the other requirements had not been met. So that really takes us to the October 1 to October 10 events, and that is where she makes the request on the form for a lateral transfer. It's now undisputed that there's no positions available. So obviously the employer is not required to demote someone else or promote her, that sort of thing. If there's no position available, then demotion is an option, and that is what Ms. Kingsolver requested. As the district court notes, there would have likely have been or a plausible discrimination case had they not granted her request for demotion after it was made.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. That's kind of where we are. Is the case is summed up. I'm happy to answer any questions about the record or the arguments, but I see that the court seems to grasp where we're coming from, at least. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Label. Ms. Moses, you've saved 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to clarify a few things concerning the issue of that. The government suggests about her being a qualified individual with a disability. She did perform. She performed the entire time she was requesting accommodation. She took one full day of sick leave and 2 half days of sick leave. And the rest of the time she was there at work and she was doing her job.
And received a fully successful performance rating.
Exactly. And so I think that, you know, that, as you say, that argument is what it is. But she had documentation of cardiac arrhythmia and brought on by workplace stress, and the employer was aware of that. As far as the tolling, and we mentioned it in our brief, we believe that the CFR, excuse me, says that the agency shall give an extension if the individual is not notified of the time limits. She was never notified of any time limits. She was never notified of any 45-day thing. She was never, none of that was ever provided to her. The training that they talk about says you may want to talk to somebody within 45 days of your retaliation. She did talk to somebody within 45 days of what she alleged was retaliation, which was the lower performance rating. So I think the rule is unclear. It was certainly communicated unclearly. The other thing, it was never raised in 16 years of administrative proceedings. They clearly accepted her complaint, and they clearly acted on it, and the EEOC acted on it. So it seems odd to me that for the first time now, nearly 20 years later, that we're talking about she didn't file it prior to starting this whole administrative procedure. And just to talk about the request for the demotion, the alleged request for the demotion. Ms. Kingsolver had made it clear to her supervisors that there were rumors that a new group of employees was coming in and there would be a position available starting October 1st. She waited, and she told them she was waiting to get this, to file this form, because she was hoping to get one of those jobs. Well, the jobs didn't materialize, and she filed the form on October 1st. And one of the things that she said on the form was that workplace stress needs to be repaired as quickly as possible. The immediate response, they never took the 100A form and moved it to HR or EEOC or any of those. Their immediate response, didn't even acknowledge receipt of it, was to add to her duties. And the stress of that was enough to send her to the doctor. What we have here, and the doctor said, you're going to have a heart attack if you don't take that demotion. That's a little bit different. And so she went in there and she said, what choice do I have? Please give me leave without pay. She said no. Her supervisor said no and said, oh, by the way, if you don't.
I mean, she doesn't want to take leave with pay because she wants to preserve her leave for future trips to Alaska.
In case her son needed her, sir. I mean, I
understand. But you know, the question is, was there duress or coercion into accepting the demotion? And it's not clear to me.
Misrepresentation, Your Honor. And, you know, to say that they weren't going to give it to her until she exhausted it, and that was the rule, and there was no such rule, that is a misrepresentation. And it would have been an alternative to the demotion, but she was not advised of it. The other thing about the demotion was Ms. Reed went into her on October the 9th, and she said, well, we've got this GS-7 we can put you in, but if you don't decide to take it today, you might have to just stay here.
Right.
And keep on going. And she said, what choice do I have? I'm going to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
So, Your Honor, we believe that a jury should hear this case.
I think we understand your case, Ms. Moses. With that, we are adjourned for the week.
Thank you, Your Honor.